Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in just a few moments, this book has been on the bestseller list for weeks now, and deservedly so. J.D. Vance will be with us, author of Hillbilly Elegy. The memoir is incredibly beautifully written and hard to read, some of the accounts of growing up in a poor Rust Belt town, and also in the Appalachian area, in Kentucky. He had so much abuse in his family, a lot of people, friends of his, dying of heroin overdoses. He writes about what it's like to be poor in Appalachia and how he came out of it and the suggestions he has for schools and for churches to help people move out of this life of real misery. J.D. Vance, very young guy, beautiful writer, will be with us momentarily, and I hope that you will listen in. Some of you, I'm sure, have already read the book. But first, I must tell you that this, Scotty's going to make me laugh. This is the Wisconsin Public Radio Membership Drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn with the marvelous Scotty Myers. You rely on WPR for informative and in-depth discussions, and we rely on you to keep programs like this one going. Your gift right now of any amount makes a huge difference. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Hello, Scotty.
Hello, Kathleen. Good to see you in the studio. Last hour, we heard from five listeners. Thank you so much for those pledges. The goal now this hour is to get 30 pledges by 2 o'clock. These goals are set up to make sure that Wisconsin Public Radio has the money to pay for the programs that you rely on. So help us meet that goal with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You probably know that your tax dollars, federal and state, already support WPR. They do, and we're grateful for that.
But listener support is actually the single biggest piece of our operating budget. You make the difference. You make the quality and variety of the programs that you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio possible. Because WPR matters to you, make a personal contribution to pay for the programs you listen to at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
This is a huge number. More than 20,000 WPR members are proud sustaining members, and they provide a steady and reliable stream of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you can join their ranks by choosing a monthly giving amount, say $10 a month, and setting it up on an ongoing basis. It's the best way to support the station that you rely on. So become a sustainer right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
This fall membership drive, ask for a set of WPR pint glasses when you give $7 a month. They've got a neat design featuring both the WPR and NPR logos. You'll get two 16-ounce glasses that will hold any kind of drink, milk, water, beer, even your favorite juice, and they're made of durable glass. Check them out at WPR.org. With these glasses, you can sip any of your favorite beverages in style while you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. Donate $7 a month right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Make your donation in support of the programs that you count on, and these will be the last couple hours that we can ask for your support for this particular show. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Scotty Myers, who along with KP Whaley helped produce this show, and a marvelous job they do. They're very, very good, so thank them. Thank them. We're here to raise the money that keeps the station and this program on the air. Your pledge might be $5 a month. Maybe it's $100 a month. We appreciate each and every one of your gifts.
Maybe you listened to WPR in school as a kid. I wasn't so lucky. I don't know about you, Kathleen, although you grew up on the south side of Chicago.
I was in Chicago.
I don't know if the frequency quite gets down there.
No. Or maybe WLS, I must tell you.
Maybe you listened in the car with your parents, or maybe you found us on your own later in life. That was the case for me, and I'm so glad I did. Either way, you probably want to see the WPR continue and provide this strong programming. It's an important part of Wisconsin.
And I missed out on it as a child. I would have listened. What a service. generous. If you've never given before, now is the time to do so. It's never too late to make that first contribution of $5 or $10 a month. It's pretty easy. It doesn't take very long. All you have to do is go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're like us, you're probably following every step of this year's election.
Oh, yeah. Hard to talk about it first thing in the morning.
That's right. Or maybe you're just an interested bystander. Either way, it's definitely an eventful.
Yes.
We could use a lot of adjectives here.
I know.
For this political season. Issues, candidates, the economy, the latest accusations and missteps. It's nonstop, and we're here to talk about it, the election and beyond. This is the recipe for good radio.
Yeah, it really is, and you hear all about it. We do marvelous election coverage, Wisconsin Public Radio, every day, and we depend on your support. Please make your gift right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Help pay for the programs you depend on. We're looking for 30 pledges by the end of the hour. Make your donation now. Support the programs and enjoy the program that we bring to you every day at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I know many of you feel like WPR is worth $1 million, but you don't have that much money to give. Well, you don't have to worry, because your gift of any amount, whether it's $5 a month or $100 a month, whatever amount you decide is an amount that you should give, and we thank you. The important thing is to make that pledge right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
We've already heard from a pair of you this hour, so we need 28 more pledges to go in the next 50 minutes or so. Give your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And this pledge drive, these are pretty popular, Scott. You can ask for a set of two of those WPR pint glasses. They have the WPR and NPR logos, and you'll be proud to drink any beverage from them. They're yours for a pledge of $7 a month or more. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
If you're not a sustainer, become one right now. It's easy. The setup is convenient. It's just an ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Jessica from Dodgeville has pledged and says, Wisconsin Public Radio is always on in the car. It's my go-to for unbiased information and inspirational topics. It is a source of inspiration. You can't underrate that.
It's
inspirational.
It's good companionship, too.
It is.
Yeah.
It's good company. And our audience is good company, and you're good company.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are.
Indeed.
Yeah. So we ask you to join Jessica and many others who says thank you for all you do. Your gift is powerful. It makes a difference. And here's how you give, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you, Kathleen. I'm really looking forward to this hour.
I am too. It should be very good.
Yeah.
And thank you for putting this hour on the air as well. This is an extraordinarily important book. It's just... it's been receiving all kinds of great reviews. It's been on the bestseller list for weeks and weeks, New York Times bestseller list. And the author tells an important story, and stories that just knock your socks off at times. He's an eloquent writer. J.D. Vance is his name. The book is Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and a culture in crisis. J.D. is from both the Appalachian town of Jackson, Kentucky, and the Rust Belt city of Middletown, Ohio. He served in the Marine Corps in Iraq after high school, graduated from Ohio State University, and then went to Yale Law School. He's now living in San Francisco, and he is a principal at a leading Silicon Valley investment firm, so he's a long way from Jackson, Kentucky. He said he wrote this book because he has achieved something quite ordinary, which doesn't happen to most kids who grow up like him. He grew up poor. He grew up very poor in the Rust Belt, Ohio's still town that has been hemorrhaging jobs and hope for as long as he can remember. J.D., thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Where did you learn to write like this? You're quite a writer.
Well,
you are.
I appreciate it. I think all the credit goes to my wife, who was just mercilessly editing as I wrote.
Was she really? Did she tell you, J.D., you need to write this book?
The person who encouraged me to write the book was actually a professor in law school, and I was writing a paper about sort of upward mobility in the American dream, and she asked, you know, why are you so interested in this stuff? And I sort of just explained my personal background, and she said, you really should turn this into a book. And she had some success writing herself, so she was able to put me in touch with the right people in the publishing industry, and that's really how the things came together. But, you know, my wife was definitely my sort of editor-in-chief, and the good thing and the bad thing about being married to a good editor is that she is not afraid to be very honest and forthright with her advice and criticism, so made the book a lot better. And, so I definitely think a lot of the credit goes to her and to some of the other folks who took a look at it for me.
Oh, that's very gracious of you. Let's start with your grandparents, because they really gave you your future in some ways, even though their lives were incredibly hard. Neither of your grandparents graduated from high school. And as you write about many of the people in this book, these are people you love. These are people who helped raise you, but their lives were incredibly complicated. And your grandparents' lives were very complicated as well. They were struggling with their own demons, but they really helped you.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, if you think about my grandparents' lives, they moved, and I really think that it's appropriate to say that they immigrated, because it was such a different world from eastern Kentucky coal country to southern Ohio at the height of the sort of Rust Belt expansion in the industrial economy. And, you know, I think on the one hand, they were very successful in Middletown. My grandpa was able to earn a good wage for his entire life, and they were able to save some money, buy a house, do all those things that we associate with the American dream. But on the other hand, they really did struggle, I think, to integrate into their community. And they didn't feel too comfortable around the sort of middle-class elites of Middletown, Ohio. They definitely felt a little bit more comfortable with their folks and their family back home. And so that created a sort of conflict where they were maybe materially doing a lot better than their family, but also felt a little culturally isolated from their new neighbors. And so they struggled in a lot of ways. I think that they gave their kids, in some ways, a good life and a good opportunity, but they also created a pretty chaotic home for their children. And as I write in the book, that, you know, that chaos, I think, caught up to our family in a lot of different ways when their kids started having their own children.
Right. You say that you may not be white. You may be white. You are white, but you don't identify with the WASPs of the Northeast, and you've spent time with them at Yale. You identify with the millions of working-class white Americans of Scots-Irish descent who have no college degree. Poverty is the family tradition, and this is a fairly kind of, as much as their lives may be shattered, it's a cohesive group. They don't like outsiders, and their ancestors really have laid a groundwork for who they are now. You identify as a Scots-Irish working-class guy, even though you're not really working-class anymore, but that's your background.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, you think of the region of Appalachia, which is huge, right? So it stretches from New York and Pennsylvania all the way down to Georgia and Alabama. But it is pretty cohesive, and there are a lot of different ethnicities in Appalachia, but there is a very, very significant Scots-Irish population. You know, it's probably most of the people living in Appalachia have some Scots-Irish connection. And I think that culture that the Scots-Irish had definitely influenced the way that families like mine grew up. You know, there was this really interesting book that came out a few years ago, drew on a study that found, you know, that folks with certain connections to Appalachia in the South were maybe a little bit more willing to engage in violence or fighting if they needed to protect their honor. And I think, you know, on the one hand, that's probably a little overstated, but I do think there's something very real about that sense of honor, the sense that you have to protect it, that you have to sort of, you know, protect it not just reputationally, but physically if you have to. And that creates both a very loyal family, but also a group of people, I think, who are a little mistrustful of outsiders.
You tell these incredible stories about your grandmother. She took up a gun when she was, what, 10 or 11 years old and shot somebody?
Yeah, so that's, you know, it's interesting. That's the family legend. As I write in the book, about half of the people had heard the story and about half of the people who I talked to hadn't. So I always wonder, you know, whether that story, as it came down to me, was a little embellished. Mm. But I think it contains an important lesson, and that's, you know, that she was sort of praised and she was thought of as a family hero for taking up a gun when she was an adolescent girl and willing to kill somebody because they were trying to steal from her family. And I do know, you know, Mamaw was, and that's what I called her, is Mamaw. She always told us that the lowest form of low was poor people stealing from other poor people. She just, you know, hated it when a bike of mine would disappear from the front porch because she said, you know, life is hard enough for poor people and we can't make it harder on each other. So she definitely had this sense that she belonged to a community of working class folks and that those people should be loyal to each other. And, you know, that story, that the idea is that she tried to shoot somebody because he was going to steal a family cow. And she did shoot him, and she wanted to finish him off before her older brother prevented her from doing so. And, you know, again, it's a tough world. I think it's a much different world, obviously, than the one that I live in now. But
Right. Really
goes to show what sort of character she was.
And there are many people. You write about the family structure and a lot of your aunts and uncles and people who lived around you. You express, even though some of these people, we would read it and say, oh, they've done atrocious things. But there is this strong love that you have for them, even though your grandpa was an alcoholic and your grandma did some things that you'd say, oh my gosh, how could anybody do something like that? But there is maybe not an acceptance of all the behavior, because some of it is really awful, but it's a culture that you've grown up with, and they've also given to you in addition to being people who are flawed people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think to everyone's families are flawed in certain ways, and there are skeletons in everyone's proverbial closet. I think in my family, they're probably a little bit more extreme, and in this region of the world, they're probably a little bit more extreme than maybe some other folks. But, you know, they're definitely, when I heard these stories of violence when I was a kid, when I heard them from my aunts or my uncles, I didn't feel shame at these stories. They weren't meant to sort of teach me a lesson that you shouldn't
Right.
act a certain way.
Yes.
They were sort of told so that I recognized how proud my family was, and that I was expected to sort of carry on the tradition in certain ways. So, you know, that definitely comes along with good things, as I write about in the book, and I have a deep affection for it. But like you said, it's not necessarily the sort of attitude that you can take with you to a modern marriage or a modern corporate boardroom. You've got to sort of unlearn some of those lessons to be successful in 21st century America. And that's, of course, you know, part of what the book is about, is how you can unlearn some of those lessons, but still hopefully keep the loyalty and devotion to your family.
Mm-hmm. You also had, and I know you probably don't want to talk about this a whole lot, but one rocky relationship, complex, you say, putting it mildly, with your parents. Your mom struggling with addiction for nearly your entire life. Husband's coming in and out of the picture. You're being left alone for most of ninth grade, to the point where you write in the book you almost failed out of high school and nearly gave in to the deep anger and resentment harbored by everyone around you. I ask this question all the time. How do some people become resilient, JD? You went to Yale, for heaven's sake. You're living in San Francisco now. How do some people become resilient?
Well, I really think it comes down to the people that you have around you. And, you know, there are two ways to sort of see my story. And one is that, yeah, you almost failed out of high school when you were in the ninth grade, and then you ended up becoming, a graduate of Yale Law School. You must have sort of pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. And I think that's one view, and maybe that's a view I was pretty attached to myself when I was young and sort of arrogant and overconfident. But the more that I thought about it, the more that I thought about it as I wrote the book, you know, it really is that I had a lot of lucky breaks, a lot of people especially that sort of entered my life at the right time. And I think back to that ninth grade version of myself, and there were so many people, big and small, who were making sure that I didn't totally fall off the cliff. There's, of course, my grandma, very important in my life. There's my dad, who had reentered my life. My sister, who was, in a lot of ways, you know, the adult in our household. Even when she was 14 or 15 years old, she was the one who took care of everybody. So I just think that what really is the difference for a lot of kids is sure, people have to start making better choices, but they also have to have some really good people in their life who make sure that they don't give in to the worst around them, and that was definitely true for me.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but you need to have churches and schools, as you tell us, also take an interest in people's family lives, because what you're bringing from home to school is not always good stuff, and it has to be recognized.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, it's not just about individual conduct, it's not just about, you know, the different economic or structural forces that they face. There are a lot of things that are in between, you know, people in the government that really matter. And so, yeah, I write a lot about church and how it was a very positive influence in my life. You know, I had great teachers and great mentors at school. And it's funny that if you look maybe at the graduation rates or if you look at the school report card, of Middletown High School, which is where I went to school, it doesn't look that good because a lot of kids are struggling. But I think if you really dig down into it, what you find is that, you know, I had a lot of opportunities and a lot of really, really great teachers at Middletown High School. And, you know, the reason I almost didn't take advantage of those opportunities didn't have so much to do with the school itself. It had a lot to do with, you know, just what I was exposed to at home and some of the stresses that we had at home.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for you. I hope some of you listening have read the book. It's been on the bestseller list for some weeks now. J.D. Vance is the author, and the book is Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. Of course, a lot has been made of particularly Donald Trump's appeal to white working class voters, and J.D. will talk about that. He examines Greater Appalachia's political reorientation from Democratic to Republican. His grandfather was a New Deal Democrat, but then he switched and voted for Ronald Reagan. So what is the appeal of Donald Trump to voters in this part of the country? We'll talk about that because, well, we have to. It's a presidential election, right? It's one of the reasons the book is getting so much attention, to figure out what is his appeal there and what made people go from FDR Democratic to Ronald Reagan Republican. Well, we'd love to hear from you, too. Our phone number, 800-486-8655 for On Air. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are in our fall membership drive, and your support of us is the foundation of our budget. It's really what makes Wisconsin Public Radio your place to go for great programs. We'll get back to J.D. Vance and Hillbilly Elegy in just a moment. First, Scotty Myers is with me to encourage YOU to go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 right now, please, to make your gift in support of the programs you count on.
I just did the quick math, which may be a little untrustworthy.
I believe you.
But we're looking for 22 more pledges in the next half hour. So far, we've heard from 3 first-time pledgers, so we really appreciate that. That's really important. Support the programs that you rely on every day.
And we thank you if you've already given. If you have not, the time is now. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Wisconsin Public Radio keeps you informed and entertained every day. The programs that you enjoy, including this one, there's also Zorba Pester and On Your Health and The People's Pharmacy and Radiolab and Chapter a Day. So many programs that air on the weekends and the weekdays.
You know, it is amazing when you listed that. You just think about it. It's unbelievable what we do every day here.
Yeah. We're on the air. Always.
Always. And it's not just, you know, with junk. We're doing important shows all the time.
Right.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, we give you a window on the world like no other. Support the exciting mix of shows that you enjoy on this station with your contribution. WPR.org 888-202-2552.
You might be paying $100 a month for your cable service. You're willing to do that because you get entertainment and information all month long.
You get these things on this station, and in fact, the quality of what you get from WPR is unmatched. You can become a sustaining member with a 9XM leadership gift of $100 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, WPR has been around for a long time.
We're almost 100 years.
Almost,
oh, you're going to say, I know, that's
jinx.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
How many years?
Almost 100.
100, I know. 100?
That's going to be a big birthday party.
Yes, it is. Big party. Lots of cake.
We're planning it now. Yeah.
For day after day.
But the reason that we got to that point, you know, here we are, is because of people like you. And so listener donations make up the single largest piece of our budget.
Your contribution makes this program possible, so many others as well. You're a part of the quality that you hear every day when you donate. If you missed it, it's WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
WPR.org is a great way to stay on top of everything that's happening this election season. You can access the headlines and dig deeper into the latest stories and important issues. Read and listen to archived stories you might have missed. Connect with WPR and fellow listeners through comments and social media. WPR.org fits into your schedule. It's always here and always current. This election season, support your source at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Pledge at WPR.org, 888-202-2552. The last day that you can pledge to this show. So if you want to pledge to us, do it today. I'm Kathleen Dunn with producer Scotty Myers, and we're asking for your support of WPR. Your gift might be $10 or $20 a month. You think about it, and then whatever amount you choose, you call us to make your gift, and we'll thank you.
On the Ideas Network, you hear diverse viewpoints from different guests. This is something that we take very seriously. That's why we're listening to JD right now and hearing these wonderful stories about his grandma and his upbringing and getting a microcosm of the broader picture throughout America. Mm-hmm. And because there's so much good food for thought on these programs, you probably find yourself starting conversations with, well, you know, yesterday on WPR, I heard, I did it last night at dinner.
You did?
Honest to goodness.
Good for you. Did people listen to you?
Well, say, sure they did.
Oh, good. Yeah, of course, because you knew what you were talking about.
They leaned in a little bit. So it's time to take actions and participate in making this show happen with your support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
So people at your table will lean in when you start talking. That's good. I like that. New members are an important part of our membership drives. Every member makes a difference because listener support makes up the single biggest part of our budget. Your donation makes WPR programs possible.
And whether you tune in for your favorite program or you find yourself checking in throughout the day or week, I recommend a steady diet indeed. You're getting value from what you hear. If you've never given before, start off with a pledge of $5 or $10 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And when you do, you will feel great.
You'll feel good. Do. You've made the decision to listen to Wisconsin Public Radio and now make the decision to support WPR financially. It's as simple as that. You really can help. So join, renew, make an extra gift. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And I'm just looking right now at the computer, and the needle has moved a little bit. We appreciate it. We're now looking for 20 pledges in the next 24 minutes.
Help out now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And this pledge drive, show your support for WPR and ask for a pair of WPR pint glasses.
They're 16-ounce glass tumblers with both the WPR and NPR logos.
Show your pride for radio you love when you give $7 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you're a sustaining member, would you make today the day you increase your support by WPR by $5 a month or two or one or 10 or whatever amount you choose? WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And Renee from Oconomowoc says, I wish I could donate more, but I hope every bit helps. It does, Renee. I especially enjoy the Larry Mueller show as well as Chapter a Day. Thank you, Renee. We really appreciate that. Your pledge right now, it's so important at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you so much, Scotty, and thanks for all the great work you do. J.D. Vance is our guest this hour. Hillbilly Elegy, been on the New York Times bestseller list for a long time, a memoir of a family and a culture in crisis. Before we talk about politics, let's talk about individual responsibility. Experience, you write, has taught you, J.D., this story of economic insecurity is incomplete. And you talk about an experience you had working the summer before Yale. Tell that story, if you would, please, and then what the meaning of that story is for the whole story we're talking about this hour.
Sure. So I was working at a tile warehouse not far from where I grew up. And, you know, most of the folks who worked there were hardworking and made a really good wage. And then a couple folks who worked there, you know, just were really content to not do the things that they needed to do. And so there was one kid in particular, younger than me, had a pregnant girlfriend, and, you know, would take these regular bathroom breaks of half an hour or even longer each time. And eventually he was fired. And I remember when he was fired, he lashed out at the owner and said, you know, how could you do this to me? And I recognized that there was a sense of a lack of agency in his response. There was no recognition on the part of this kid that he had messed up, that the reason he had lost his job wasn't something that anybody had done to him. It was something that he had done to himself. And it sort of, you know, hit me, and it's something I'd thought a lot about growing up, that there were a significant number of folks, and not the majority, so definitely not most people, but there were a pretty large minority of people who felt that their choices didn't matter in some significant way. And so what I'm trying to highlight with that story is something I think is very real and observable in the data. It's that, you know, we've got to reclaim this sense of agency, this sense that our choices matter, and that's what I was trying to get across with that story.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk politics for a little bit. You talk about your grandfather being a New Deal Democrat, FDR supporter when he was in Ohio, and then changing to become a Reagan supporter, the whole political landscape changing in Appalachia. Why did your father change his political allegiance?
Well, yeah, so I called him, my grandpa called him Papaw, and, you know, I wouldn't say that he even changed his political allegiance as much as he just really disliked Reagan's opponent in 1984. You know, the only time I ever heard him talk bad about a Democrat is when he said, you know, I really never liked that SOB Mondale. He just seemed like a northern liberal elite. And so what he really disliked was this sense of maybe cultural alienation, that Walter Mondale came from a different clique, a different social category, and maybe looked down on people like him. That was the sense for why he probably voted for Reagan. But, you know, Papaw voted, as I understand it, for Bill Clinton, I think, both times. So he wasn't an ideological guy. He was just a classic sort of blue dog Democrat. And I really wonder, you know, Papaw isn't alive today, but I really wonder if he would vote for Donald Trump. My guess is that he probably wouldn't, but I think he'd be very tempted to.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the cultural alienation, the culture, the dominant culture is what? And what are people specifically feeling alienated from?
Well, my sense is that for a lot of the working class folks in town, things have not gone very well. So it's been tougher to get a good job.
Sure.
It's, you know, been tougher for your kids to get an education, for them to rise through the economic ranks. But they've also seen a lot of social decay around them. So the stuff I write about in the book, from the drug addiction to the family breakdown. And so there's a real sense of pessimism, I think, about the lives that folks are leading. And that pessimism in some way needs to find an outlet. And so what I've seen definitely over the past 10 or so years is an increasing frustration and alienation at people who are perceived to have political or financial power. And I think that alienation comes from a couple sources. One, it comes from a feeling that those people don't even care about our problems. They don't even recognize our problems. That's one side of it. And the second side of it is that they're a little bit condescending if they even deign to think about us in the first place. So they don't really care, and they also seem to look down on us if they do care at all. And that twin sense of frustration is my guess for what really drives a lot of the Trump phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. The number of, and you talk about going home and having, and this is a small community, and learning about the dozens, not just a couple, dozens of heroin overdose deaths in the community. How prevalent is that, and why are so many people using heroin?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a crazy statistic. In the Ohio County where I grew up last year, there were more deaths from drug overdoses than there were from natural causes.
Wow.
As I understand it, in 2016, that statistic is going to be the same, but even worse. So, you know, my guess is that people turn to heroin for the reasons that they turned to alcohol 60 years ago. You know, it's a certain amount of hopelessness about your own life. Maybe a little bit of boredom because it's tougher to find a job. You have a lot more time on your hands. But if you think about what heroin is, right, it's an analgesic. It's something that, you know, people prescribe morphine to take away folks' pain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk to people who do heroin, it just makes things sort of go away for a little while. It makes them feel better, really gives them a sense that things are all right. And my guess is that there's just so much pain in these communities that a lot of folks feel compelled to turn to heroin to take away the pain.
And then it creates more pain because you're stealing from your neighbors, right?
Well, exactly. You're stealing from your neighbors, and you're introducing something into your own families that just causes a ton of hurt. You know, there are people who have really ruined the entire lives of their families because of heroin. The amount of money that folks, you know, grandparents or siblings spend to try to get people through drug treatment and drug addiction, the effect that it has on their children, social services coming in and disrupting the home. It's just a really, really messy situation once you introduce a drug that's so addicting and so powerful.
And you have experience because your mom, a drug addict, and your grandmother, you discovered after her death, had spent a lot of money getting your mom in various rehab facilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we knew that Mamaw was helping out a lot financially. I don't think that we realized quite the scale of the help until after she died and realized that, you know, I lived with her and realized that she was poor, but I don't think any of us realized just how poor she was until she died. And, you know, that's absolutely the case. It was a really tough situation for our family. I think it continues to be a tough situation for our family, but it's not that uncommon. It's just amazing how common these stories are of folks who've had their lives upended by drugs in one way or another.
If you'd like to speak with J.D., we're going to take some phone calls right now. Our number is 800-486-8655. J.D. Vance, author of the New York Times bestseller Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. 800-486-8655. Jason in Portage is calling in. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Well, you know, I originally called because you were talking about Donald Trump and why people are, you know, attracted to him and all that. But then now that I'm talking to J.D., hi, J.D.,
hi.
Now that I was listening to him, now you got off on a track that I need to be a little bit more passionate about. This is what you guys are calling a heroin epidemic. You know, and I heard you ask, why are people turning to it? I can tell you from personal experience why a lot of the people that I know have turned to it, are still doing it, are, you know, managing, or what would they say, managing addicts, I guess I'd say. A lot of people, and again, Wisconsin just passed a new law about the opiate law with the doctors. I can tell you personally that my doctor, I was on fentanyl patches 4 years for my chronic pain. My doctor just kicked me out of her practice and gave me a reason that I missed too many appointments, but I had never missed an appointment. And it just so happens to be 1 week after the new law went into effect. So a lot of the reason people are going to heroin is because they can't get the stuff that the doctors, you know, have them on. They're dependent on it for years, like me, 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, I've suffered because of that. And there's been many times where I've thought, oh, heroin's the same. I'll go do it. They got to have it. But, a month of hell of withdrawals. And I tell you, there's been many a times laying in my bed thinking about it. I would love to go back to it. I would love to. But, you know, I didn't. But that's why people are doing it. A lot of people, they get strung out from their doctors, or they're, you know, chemically dependent on this stuff because of pain and other things in their, you know, their daily lives, and then their doctors cut them off because it's easier for them to not have patients because they can only have a certain amount of opioid patients right now.
Yeah, JD.
Yeah, well, that's definitely, you know, that's another part of the story, is that you talk about folks who are, you know, one, maybe overprescribed opioids to begin with, or are maybe underprescribed opioids later on, and that's definitely a big driver of the epidemic. Is, you know, it's just the doctors a lot of times are not really prescribing with a recognition that a lot of times this stuff can lead to an addiction, much worse. Like your caller said, if they end up getting cut off. And that's a big part of the story, is that whether it's the doctors or whether it's pharmaceutical companies, I don't think we quite recognize how addictive this stuff is over the long term, how it can become a really important part of somebody's functioning. And, you know, again, just add that as another element of what's going on with this heroin stuff.
Thank you very much, Jason, for the call. This email comes in from Paulette. JD, how can a person in Appalachia pull themselves out of poverty if they're willing to work hard but don't have the personal ability to join the military or go to college?
Well, that's a really, you know, that's just a really tough question, because unfortunately there aren't a whole lot of avenues to upward mobility in the country. You know, college is one of them. The military is another. And so the way that I think about it is that we've probably got to think about how we can provide more avenues to getting out of poverty for folks in Appalachia or any other impoverished situation, because it is a real big problem. And if you look at the statistics, unfortunately, if you don't go to college, if you don't join the military, and you grew up poor in some of these areas, the deck is really stacked against you, and I'd like to see that change.
Mm. The common course of conversation, particularly during a political season, if only they had better access to jobs, other parts of their lives would improve as well. You say you once held this opinion yourself, not having a job is stressful. Obviously, the economic component, the jobs component, is an important one to not only have a job, but show up for your job, too, and work at it really hard. But there have to be, there just weren't many jobs available in the area where you grew up. What is that component that we need to do something about, creating jobs?
Well, it's got to be a really important part of any solution. I think the point that I try to make in the book is that I don't think it's a total solution. So even if you have a lot of economic development in these areas, even if you have rising wages, it's going to help the people, again, the majority of people who are really trying hard to get ahead. But you're still going to have a pretty significant minority of folks who are struggling in ways that are unrelated to their economic circumstances, whether it's the drugs or the family breakdown and so forth. So my sense is that economic development, better jobs, rising wages are really important and would definitely help the problem, but they're not going to totally fix it altogether.
Mm-hmm. How important were the Marines to you?
Oh, it was incredibly important.
It gave me
an opportunity to really be forced into learning some of the soft skills that I didn't know, you know, from ironing a uniform to figuring out my finances. The Marine Corps really taught me that. But second, it also exposed me to a different set of circumstances and a different life. There's not a whole lot that I knew about the world outside of Middletown, outside of Eastern Kentucky before I joined the Marines, but they definitely changed that.
Mm-hmm. Are you amazed that here you are on the New York Times bestseller list and you're all over television? And I mean, holy cow, it must strike you every now and then. Whoa, how did this happen in my life? Doesn't it?
Oh, it definitely does. It strikes me as awfully surreal every few hours. I think to myself, what in the world is going on here? I can't say anything other than yeah, sometimes I wake up and go, I can't believe that this has happened to me, but definitely really appreciate it. And most of all, you know, what's been really interesting about this experience and the part that I appreciate the most is just how many kids who grew up like I did in my hometown and close by who've reached out and said, you know, I really appreciate you giving a voice to our experiences, because I don't think a lot of folks realize that,
right,
you know, the problem I write about, you know, it is a memoir, but it is also, I think, very representative of how a large segment of the working class is living these days.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing that's eye-opening about it, and shame on us for not having a better understanding, because we just haven't paid enough attention. But you write about things that I must say I was amazed by. I was amazed by, and I know that part of the world some. I know Appalachia some. I haven't been there in a long time. But we just haven't paid any attention, and that's the other thing you've done. You made us pay attention, which is an important thing to do. So even though you're 31, it's okay. You wrote a memoir, right?
Sure. Well, yeah. It still seems a little weird to have written a memoir at my age, but, you know, everything's gone well, so I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. Well, you're young. You can do another one. Thanks, J.D. Thanks so
All
much
right, thank
for
you.
Being with us.
Okay. Yeah, take care.
J.D. Vance, the book is Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. It's been on the bestseller list for weeks now, and deservedly so. This is the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Scotty Myers, and our goal is to keep bringing you topics like J.D. Vance. He's an extraordinary young man and an important topic. Next hour is Senator George Mitchell, who's done amazing things all over the world. It's your support that makes these conversations happen, and they don't happen in other places. I think you know that. Give now. Any amount will make a difference. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Kathleen, I'm looking at the clock. It's exactly 1:52 and 17 seconds, which means we have less than 8 minutes to get 16
okay.
pledges. Come on, let's bring it in. So, because your support helps keep this station strong. Help pay for the Kathleen Dunn Show with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
How can you ignore that request from Scotty? I mean, seriously, how can you? You've been enjoying the conversation with J.D. Vance about what's going on in Appalachia and his story of how he went from there to the Marines to Yale eventually. It's an hour of the really important and very substantial conversations that we have on this show.
So now take a few minutes to make this hour and many more hours possible. Choose a gift amount that works for you. Then make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If listening to WPR is worth $4 a day to you, you can become a member of our 9XM Leadership Circle. They are listeners who contribute $1,200 or more a year to support WPR programs, and that works out to less than $4 a day.
If you find that you've been getting more value from WPR in the past year, consider a contribution that puts you in the 9XM Leadership Circle. Make your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
A lot of thought goes into what we select as thank you gifts during our membership drives. We ask people for their ideas, check out what other public radio stations are offering, do lots of internet research. And it's all worth it because we want you to have the best WPR logo items possible. We love the new WPR pint glasses and think you will too. Here are some of our WPR staff members to tell you why.
I would probably put water with a twist of lime in it.
I like that it's got both WPR and NPR's logos on them.
Oh, well, it could certainly hold, yeah, candies or pens or hair accessories comes to mind.
Donate $7 a month or more and ask for your pair of WPR pint glasses. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Go to WPR.org, 888-202-2552 to make your pledge. It's the last couple hours that you can pledge to this particular show. So if you want to do this show, pledge now, huh? I'm Kathleen Dunn with Scotty Myers, and we're asking for your support. Your gift, think about it, $10, $15 a month, whatever you choose. We thank you for what you give us.
When you give today, become a sustainer. As a sustaining member, you'll give a monthly amount, say $10 or $15, like Kathleen said, and that will automatically come out of your bank account or credit card. Your monthly gift will continue until you ask us to make a change.
That means we can depend on you the way you depend on us, and I know you do, and that's a really good dependence. It's day in, day out, year in, year out. The years go on. It's just a wonderful thing that's happening here, and you're in control. You can change your giving at any time. It's a very convenient way to give, and it's helpful to us, so become a sustainer. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
When you listen to the talk shows on WPR's Ideas Network, you participate in a statewide conversation. We found that out earlier this week when we had Ari Berman on from The Nation talking about voting rights. A listener called in, and sure enough, our guest, Ari, was so intrigued by it that it led him to write a whole story from our show, from our listeners. That's how valuable you are. So you hear from the experts, and you also learn from these interesting and diverse experiences of your neighbors all across the state of Wisconsin.
And we don't tell you often enough, so let me tell you now that so many of our guests, and Scotty hears from them, who say what a great audience you have, because you do. You ask. It's just wonderful to have direct interaction with you. And you, from us, I think, go into the world a more rounded person every day. You have all kinds of topics to think and talk about, and people will lean in to hear your conversations because you value being well informed, and we do that for you. Make a pledge to the station that keeps you connected. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
All right, it's the home stretch. We're looking for 16 pledges in the next 4 minutes. Give to WPR to support the station you love, your public radio.
Thank you if you've already given. If you haven't, help pay for the programs you enjoy by making your contribution right now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Give the amount that works for you. And if you need some help figuring that out, consider this. Say you hear three things a day that you're really glad you heard. Now, if you paid a dime for each one of those things, that would work out to $10 a month. Make that contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
16 more pledges to go and not a whole lot of time to get them, so pledge at the moment, please. Your gift right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552, really does help.
And this pledge drive, you can ask for a set of two WPR pint glasses. They've got both the WPR and NPR logos. You'll be proud to drink any beverage from them. They're yours for a pledge of $7 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And Jessica from Dodgeville says, I'm already a sustaining member, but I just had to have those pint glasses. Thanks for all you do.
Your gift is powerful. It really makes a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We have 14 more pledges to go, Scotty, and now is the time to do it. We are not going to be asking our show. I'm not here on Friday, and so today is the last day we'll be asking for your support, last hour and 3 minutes and 15 seconds or whatever it is. So please, if you'd like to pledge to us, do it now.
Yeah, it means a lot. And let me tell you, to tee it up for you next hour, we have the former Senate Majority Leader, George Mitchell. I got to go greet him right now, so I'm going to step out of the studio, Kathleen.
Okay.
And we're going to have another fantastic hour of
radio. I know we are. I know. Thanks, Scotty. What a joy it is to work with Scotty and KP. They're good. So thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour as well, the very interesting hour with J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, Senator George Mitchell, who negotiated the peace treaty in Northern Ireland. He did the couple tours of Mideast peace envoy. He was Senate Majority Leader. He's had an incredible life. He'll be with us hour two.